This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Centenary celebration of Stravinsky's masterpiece, bringing Portland into the worldwide honor of the Rite of Spring, which is considered to be the most iconic performing arts achievement of the 20th century. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 11 o'clock. Coming up next on Stage and Studio, Demi Roberts presents an inspiring talk by Portland filmmaker Brian Lindstrom, who spoke to emerging filmmakers about his critically successful film, Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews artist Meridon Duckler about the current show at Blackfish Gallery called Ritual the Show, which invites visitors to partake in three separate experiences that combine ritual and art. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I'm Demi Roberts, Stage and Studio. Today I feature Portland filmmaker Brian Lindstrom. His latest documentary, Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie, garnered critical success during its premiere at the Portland International Film Festival in February 2013, and more recently at the Big Sky Documentary Film Festival in Montana. The riveting and emotional film Alien Boy focuses on the life of James Chassie, a Portland man diagnosed with schizophrenia when he was a teen. At the age of 42, Chassie was tackled down by police in downtown Portland. He died from multiple broken bones and a punctured lung while in police custody. Here's a clip from the trailer of Alien Boy.
He was a guy that you'd think, he's going to write some great poetry, he's going to do some great art.
This person was part of the original punk rock movement.
He was dealing with inner demons.
He was frightened all the time.
Told me that he was living in hell. Help me, help me. And it wasn't Jim Jim anymore.
It's very difficult for people to recover from a mental illness, and he was managing things well.
10 years of being a police officer, and I've never seen anybody look at me like that with the sheer terror in their eyes. I'll never forget seeing that face, and I knew he was going to run.
Jim was in a bad shape. He needed to be hospitalized again. We felt he had gone off his meds.
I looked up just as the four men were hitting the pavement.
If you try and bite me or kick me, it's going to be really, really bad.
And take some pictures here. Take some pictures.
Kicked him a few times.
Hit him 3 times.
Screaming, don't kill me, don't kill me, don't kill me.
It is my opinion that if he had been transported to the hospital, he probably would have survived.
I don't believe a jail cell is the right place to help mentally ill people deal with their problems.
I don't believe for a second that there was ever any ill intent on any of those three officers.
It sounded to me like he had been beaten to death.
You know, I look at what happened to Jim Jim that day, and I look at the city's response, and I just say, it's not Jim Jim who's crazy.
Alien Boy took 6 years for Lindstrom to make, and it's currently being submitted to festivals around the country. Lindstrom's mission as a filmmaker has been to tell the hard stories of grit and grace of people on the fringes of society. His other films include Finding Normal, about drug addiction, and Writing Myself, a film about Playwright, a group that creates original theater with at-risk youth. Brian Lindstrom recently came to talk to Mount Hood Community College's Integrated Media Program, where I've been teaching. Here's his talk, recorded live, with the students. Lindstrom started off talking about his six-year journey making Alien Boy.
It's the only film ever to be shown to the inmates in solitary confinement at Oregon State Penitentiary. And, you know, I think we all make films for different reasons and maybe even for different audiences, but the idea that someone in that state could see my film is very meaningful to me, and I feel grateful for that. So I had been working in the cinema verite mode, and my friend Jason Renault invited me out for coffee one day, and Jason's been an advocate for people with mental illness for about the last 30 years, and he's just someone who I really deeply respect. And we had been kind of looking for a project that we might work on together, And he asked me if I knew about James Chassie. This was like in 2006, and I didn't, because I'd been out of town when James had his unfortunate, basically when the police beat James. And so he told me about Jim's story. And what struck me was that this kind of terrible cascade of events and decisions on the police part that led to Jim's death was just really outrageous. And what really drew me to the story was I felt like that kind of narrative track, that thrust, that outrage would maybe garner an audience for the film and would allow people to also see what I really wanted to show in the film, which is the resilience and integrity with which Jim led his life. After this terrible thing happened and Jim died in police custody, the police chief and the mayor tried to frame it as a failure of the mental health system, which was really outrageous to me because, first of all, there's no one to stand up for the mental health system because it's so kind of fractured and underfunded. So it's a really easy target. But second of all, Jim was a success story. He was living independently. He had a room at an SRO, a single room occupancy hotel downtown called Swindells on Broadway and Burnside. And he was living a life the best he could. You know, he was he had his kind of beloved daily routine. He was a member of a couple different churches. He loved Powell's books. He loved the library. He maintained relationships with his family. You know, he had a life that had meaning and beauty the same way that all our lives do, and also had challenge. Anyway, I just couldn't kind of let it sit that they were trying to frame it in that regard. And so Jason and I decided, well, let's make this film. And it turned into this, like, you know, six-year odyssey. And there were all kinds of ups and downs and little or no money almost all the time. And always working, you know, with not enough resources or whatever, but also just always knowing that we were in this very kind of privileged position of telling Jim's story and that story needed to get out there. You know, so I think it's always important to kind of think, why are you doing a project? Because you really have to be pretty secure in that knowledge, because it's going to be what propels you above all the obstacles and, you know, interruptions and heartbreaks that every project runs into. So we were able to make the film, and I was very gratified that at the premiere at the Portland International Film Festival, I was able to introduce Mayor Charlie Hales to Jim's dad, James Chassie Sr., and they had a very nice and meaningful conversation about what steps might be taken to prevent any kind of tragedy like this ever happening again. And it's those kinds of conversations that are kind of the reason I make films, because most of my films are about people that the audience might otherwise kind of put an X through and think like, oh, there's an addict or an ex-con or a person with mental illness, and, you know, put them into a category. And, you know, if we dig deeper, there's always something else there, right? There's the fullness of that person, that, you know. And so I think film is a great medium to explore that and to connect people with people they might not otherwise connect to. I went to junior high school and high school in Park Rose, and that's where I grew up. And so I've always had a kind of warm spot in my heart for Mount Hood. And in eighth grade, I had an English teacher named Mr. Greenfield, and it was December, and he asked us to write down everything we wanted for Christmas. And you can imagine, like, you know, pages and pages, like, you know, he challenged us to be as detailed as possible, and we were happy to do it. And he said, okay, put that list aside. And he showed us a 17-minute film called A Day in the Life of Bonnie Consuelo. And it's a cinema verite documentary that follows Bonnie Consuelo, this housewife and mother in Florida, through her day. Like, nothing too remarkable. She gets her kids ready for school. She makes lunches. She goes shopping. She makes dinner. She, you know, has lunch with friends. Kind of just all the typical things it takes to, you know, keep a family going. Nothing very remarkable except for one thing. Bonnie Consuelo had no arms. And so Mr. Greenfield showed us that film. And then he turns the lights on and he says, okay, who wants to share their Christmas wish list with the class? And of course, like, there's just, you know, just stunned silence, because no one wants to say, like, yeah, I want, you know, the latest Eagles album or, you know, whatever it is. Because that film had taught us that everything we really know was deep inside us already. And if Bonnie Consuelo could access that, then so could we. And it was just one of those moments where I realized, wow, Mr. Greenfield, by showing us that film, first of all, he made the whole class silent, which was a challenge in and of itself with eighth graders. But he really, like, changed kind of, I think, how all of us viewed ourselves and kind of what it meant to be human. And all that in, like, a 17-minute film, you know, and also in the beautiful way that Mr. Greenfield used that film. And I just remember thinking to myself, wow, film is pretty powerful, and I kind of made a note of that. And later on in my life, when I was a little bit more kind of coherent and focused, I knew I wanted to tell stories. And I thought film would be the best medium for me to do that. And so that's kind of how I went forward from there.
You had a lot of critical success at the Portland International Film Festival and also Big Sky, right? And has that already happened, Big Sky Film Festival?
Yeah, that was in February. And then we just got back from Minneapolis, where we showed it at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival. And it's always a real treat to show the film outside of Portland because, you know, this isn't just a Portland story. I mean, it would be a great world if only Portland had to worry about the way that mentally ill and police interact at times, but it's a national and even international story, and the audience is there just as engaged with Jim's resilience and his integrity and just as outraged with, you know, what happened to him.
But there were a lot of challenges to this. And do you want to, like, sort of break it down what the challenges were?
Sure. Well, the first challenge is as this was winding its way through the court system and the grand jury and all that, it was a very controversial thing. And we kind of had to win people's trust to even agree to be interviewed. And I think a huge help in that was the track record of our producer, Jason Renault, and his advocacy work on behalf of people with mental illness. So I think that really kind of helped us win the trust of people so that they would talk to us. And, you know, a lot of the challenge was just that we didn't have access to kind of all the players in the story, if you will. And the reason we didn't was because there was a gag order that prevented people in the civil case from talking to us. So for the longest time, the family couldn't even legally talk to us. And so that presented, you know, a huge obstacle. But, you know, one thing I've learned about, like, all the obstacles in filmmaking is that oftentimes you look back and it's almost like there's a kind of golden silver thread, you know, kind of divine intervention type of thing that you kind of, in retrospect, think, oh, well, those hardships were the best things possible. And the reason I'm saying that is because we didn't have access to, you know, Jim's family for a long time and other people in the case, we just focused on Jim's personal life, mainly on the people that kind of came of age with him in Portland's early punk scene. And so it allowed us to kind of really get to know Jim as a person and to tell his story. And I think that in many ways, that's what really makes the film kind of coalesce, is the idea that the audience gets to identify with Jim. It really gets to understand what it's like to have a severe and persistent mental illness and still kind of overcome that in some respect and lead a meaningful life. So, you know, it's like running a marathon or something. You think back to those early blisters and, you know, they're part of what compelled you across the finish line.
So let's talk about some of the legal battles, too. I mean, because what's remarkable about this film is that, I mean, for one thing, it's a great film, but also, you know, having to take 6 years to do it, which is not actually unheard of, you know, right, in the world of feature-length documentary, and then raising all this money. But then you also had some other obstacles that most people may not have to deal with.
Well, first of all, there's a challenge of telling someone's story who's no longer alive and you don't have access to. You know, that's a big one. And it puts you in a very privileged and precarious position. That's a lot of alliteration right there. And the reason it does that is because you have to make some choices and you have to have some kind of intuitive connection to the person. And yet you also are looking for a kind of pathway from the people who knew this person that lets you know that you're on the right path. So it becomes, in a sense, you become the guardian of a spirit, if you will, and you have to really take that seriously because it's a big responsibility. You know, as enraging as the police actions were, that caused Jim's death and then also kind of caused the cover-up, and I don't know how else to describe it except a cover-up. I'm not trying to be pejorative, but it's just, you know, when someone's not telling the truth and is making up a lie, it seems to me that's a cover-up. As awful and dark as all that is, to me, what really shines through in the film is much more the kind of light of Jim's spirit. It's a long slog to get up and make a film regardless, but if you're making a film to condemn, you know, that's kind of, I don't know, that's a long road to hoe. Andrew Saunderson, the editor, and myself, and Jason Renault, the producer, and John Campbell, the director of photography, I think that what really motivated us was really to share Jim's light rather than to wallow in the police force's darkness.
You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dime Roberts. This is a talk by Portland filmmaker Brian Lindstrom with students at Mount Hood Community College's Integrated Media Program. If you missed any of the show, listen again at stageandstudio.org, where you can find links to this program, as well as links to Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassis, and Brian Lindstrom's work.
The film would not have been made without the taped and the video that you got from the police, would it? I mean, it would have been a whole nother film.
Yeah, basically what happened is that we were working for the longest time without having access to any of the material of the videotaped police depositions or the audio of the police investigation. And then what happened was the family and the city settled the civil suit, and the family's attorney, Tom Steenson, gave us a big box, and in that box were all the videotaped depositions of the officers involved, the enhanced jailhouse footage with the enhanced audio so you could kind of hear what the officers are saying, and then audio recordings of the police interviews of eyewitnesses. And those elements just really helped, I think, kind of flesh out the story and really make it kind of well-rounded. And it was also helpful that you got to see the officers' faces. I think that was a huge, important step.
You heard from the officers?
Not from the officers involved. A person from the training division came to one of the screenings of Cinema 21 and came up afterward and thanked us for making the film.
When you first pick up the story, did you pick the story as a good story, or did you pick up the story as a compassion? Oh, I just love this guy. I wanted to. How did you, like, you know, picked it up? Like, you pick up it through compassion, or did you pick up as a good story?
You know, I don't know what it is. We all have that little internal barometer, and suddenly it goes into the red, and you think, like, okay, this is a film I'm going to make. What kind of cemented it for me was when I started to talk to people that knew James, or Jim Jim as he was called when he was a teen. And I was really struck by the impact that he had on those people. They all kept things that he had given them 20 and even 30 years earlier, you know, little drawings or a handwritten poem. And I just thought, wow, you know, if people cared about him that much to keep those things, it probably meant that an audience might also care a lot about him too. And so the opportunity to kind of share that with an audience was a huge motivator in us making the film.
But you had a personal connection to this topic, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm always kind of on the lookout for ways to use film to kind of expand, you know, I don't know how else to say it, maybe our definition of what it means to be human. You know, I mean, I've really enjoyed following addicts going through recovery and just this idea that, you know, there are those people out there in the world, I'm not one of them, but whose families haven't been touched by addiction or mental illness. And it's really rewarding after seeing my films to hear people say, oh, you know, I never really realized that addiction is a disease. And in that disease, the addict's mind is telling them, use the drug, it will make things better, even though they know from, you know, years and years of personal experience that's not the case, that there still is that inner voice. Film is such a great medium to really help people understand the other, you know, and I really love using it in that way.
And any other questions?
I've done a lot of documentary kind of stuff, or I've been trying to on different activism issues. Like, I did a kind of a music video type thing on homelessness, and I did a wheelchair accessibility kind of thing. And I want to do something more along those lines or similar to what you've done. And that's like really inspiring. And I was just wanting to, if you had any good avenues to start on or any advice as far as going out into the public. And like, I want to go talk to people with homelessness issues and mental health issues. You know, I've seen some of that. I've had some of that in my life, and I've seen it around me too. And so I kind of relate to it. And like, how do you go out and start talking to people? And like, well, what methods did you use to start tracking down the story behind this and start finding like the real life stories behind these people? Where would you start, you know, when, if you're trying to find a personal story or how personal stories go together?
Well, first of all, I think you're starting out exactly the right way. You know, you're using your films to kind of explore these issues, and I think what you need to, and you're already on the lookout for, but now your challenge is how to kind of get beyond issues and get into personal stories. And I think that, first of all, you have a personal connection to it, it sounds like, right? And I think people are going to sense that when you approach them. And so I think they're going to respond very positively, you know, to your wanting to maybe discuss the possibility of, you know, making a film about them. So now I think it's really just a matter of you putting yourself in the position of encountering those people. You know, I mean, I love in the film where Russell Sacco says that he approached Jim, you know, several times and Jim wouldn't say anything. And then finally that one time Jim talked back and suddenly a conversation happened.
You know, I've been in those positions, and I wasn't comfortable like coming walking up to someone and like, hey, what's your story? Like,
right.
It seemed like I was trying to find a good avenue in order to start a conversation, but is it just walking up to people just randomly with your camera away and just having a conversation with them, and then you find a personal story, or...
How do you get access, right, essentially?
The closest parallel I can make with my films is when I made Finding Normal, and it wasn't like I just walked into Hooper Detox and said, hi, I'm Brian, I have a camera, let's do it. I mean, it was really like a, you know, I don't want to tell you how many years it took to kind of build up the relationship to make that film because it would probably discourage you, but it was like, you know, taking tiny steps first so that I kind of became known in that community and people understood, you know, my motivations and also, you know, could trust that, you know, that I would tell a full story and, you know, and was kind of in it for the right reasons. And I think that, you know, it is a very daunting thing. Hi, I want to make a film. How about you being in it, you know? But I think at some point you also kind of just have to make that leap of faith. And, you know your reasons are pure. And I think they will, the other people will understand that too. And I also know that you probably have enough drive and a commitment because of your personal experiences that, you know, you'll be able to overcome the people just not wanting to be part of it or all the rejections that we all have to face when we're asking people, hey, you know, I want to make this film. It's about this topic. Will you participate?
Obviously, in his story, there's a lot of individuals, and how did you, for one, find out that those people were related to him in that way? But how did you reach out to them, like Sam Henry? I mean, he's a somebody here that not a lot of people know about, but he's kind of a friend of mine, and it was really cool. I was like, that's Sammy. How do you connect those people?
You know, what's so cool about making films is that you kind of, after every project, you kind of get a little clearer picture of like, oh, this is why I make films. And I think one of the reasons is kind of just what you're asking, is that you, making a film like this is uncovering a community and then in some ways kind of gently but assertively putting yourself in that community. And I think that's what happens in a film like this, is that you talk to one person and they mention someone, and then you talk to that person, you kind of just slowly, you know, kind of get all these people that have a certain perspective on this one person. And in making Alien Boy, we really cast a wide net. We interviewed 70 people. You know, there are a lot of people we interviewed that didn't even make it into the film, but we really wanted to kind of feel like we didn't leave any stone unturned. I don't mean to imply that the people we interviewed lived under rocks, but you know what I mean? It was like we really wanted to kind of not have a lot of assumptions and just really leave ourselves open to these wonderful stories that might emerge, you know? And I also, you know, to me it was kind of intimating that this, you know, there's this thing called the pre-interview where you kind of decide, is this someone you want to talk to? And for this project, I really kept that kind of pre-interview thing to a minimum. It was basically like if I felt like the person definitely knew Jim and had something to say, that's basically all I wanted to know, and then we would set up an interview, because I didn't want to kind of use up the kind of freshness of the story, which can happen sometimes. Sometimes you'll find that you do these great pre-interviews, and then you get to the time where you're shooting it, and you kind of realize, oh, I see what's happened here. I used up all the juice in the pre-interview, and now they're just kind of feeling like, you know, they're rehashing it, you know? So if I would just give some advice about that, I would say, like, as soon as you kind of know, okay, this person belongs in my film, or at least this person deserves the chance to be in the film, we'll do the interview, I would say stop the pre-interview.
Quit talking.
Yeah, exactly. just set the date and then be quiet, yeah.
So how many hours of footage, did you try to see what was in your archive?
I have like well over 100 hours of footage at least, and then, and that's just stuff we shot. Then there's this kind of a gray area of like archival material of bands or other things that, you know, we had access to and had to kind of winnow down.
I think it's hard for me to watch this film again, what actually happened to him in the police station. It's so crucial to have that footage and I commend you for it, but you must have had to watch that over and over again, and I just found it so difficult the first time. I start crying about it when I think about it.
Yeah, it was really harrowing for Andrew Saunderson and I to edit that, and we had to both keep our hearts open to the footage, and yet also have to use kind of our brains to figure out like what is the appropriate amount so that the audience gets the full impact of the brutality and the suffering, but yet not so much that it crosses some line and you become kind of closed off to it. So it was really a challenge, but it was also the kind of thing where every time in the editing room where we would go through that scene, we never didn't feel it. You know, I mean, it's just not something you can watch and not be moved by.
One last question from somebody who hasn't asked a question.
I'm Dave. I'm impressed with your tenacity to stay with that. It's a long time to be working on a project, any project. At what point did you settle on an editing style or a style of the film? Because you were with us for quite a long time, and so a lot of things changed, and you were research and things kept popping up. And
that's a really great question. The hardest thing for Andrew and I, the editor and I, to come up with was kind of the placement of Jim's personal story. For the longest time, we started out with the eyewitnesses talking about what happened that day, and then we would go into we finally landed upon. After I think probably eliminating every mathematical possibility of the different arrangements of scenes, that it made much more of an emotional impact for us to really get to know Jim before we found out about the horrors of what happened that day. And so finally we landed on that. But it was really a kind of trial and error about the arrangement of the order of scenes. And, I think that's what's so beautiful and daunting about the editing process, and thank God for non-linear editing systems, right? Because you can really just kind of try everything without, having to reassemble it by hand or anything. But we really tried, almost every possible permutation of it, but it really seemed to make the most sense to get the full impact of Jim's personal story first and then go into the case. And I think that was also the most humanizing approach to Jim, I think.
I really appreciate you taking the time to be here today, and thank you so much for the film and also just for your time and your expertise in sharing that.
That's my pleasure. Thank you, everyone.
That was filmmaker Brian Lindstrom talking with my students at Mount Hood Community College's Integrated Media Program. If you want to find out more about Alien Boy and any upcoming screenings of the film, visit alienboy.org. Lindstrom's latest project is Dreamers, a youth video project he produced with the I Have a Dream Foundation. The film profiles 6 teens who entered the I Have a Dream program as first graders at Woodlawn Elementary School in North Portland. Dreamers premieres at Woodlawn Park before Movies in the Park on Saturday, July 6th, before dusk around 9 p.m. Find out more about the premiere of Dreamers at stageandstudio.org. Before we go today, the end of the school year and the Rose Parade always brings out the Mount Tabor Middle School Marching Band to rehearse in my neighborhood. It's a treat having 150 students playing music and walking right around my block. I got out my recording gear and recorded this from the Mount Tabor Middle School Marching Band, led by music teacher Kim Heron. That's it for Stage and Studio. You can always find podcasts of all of our shows at stageandstudio.org or on iTunes. And you can like us at the Stage and Studio Facebook page at facebook.com/stage_studio. You can also tweet me at @stage_studio. Until next time, I'm Dime Roberts. We're going out with more by the Mount Tabor Middle School Marching Band.
Thanks for listening, and thanks, members, for supporting KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Art Focus with host Joseph Gallivan. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon College of Art and Craft, a creative community in Portland. OCAC invites you to its open house for undergraduate degree programs on June 22nd at 1 p.m. You can RSVP at www.ocac.edu.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week, our guest is Mary Dawn Duckler. She is part of Ritual the Show, a group exhibit at Blackfish Gallery, running from June 4th to June 29th. Welcome, Mary Dawn. It's lovely to have you here at KBOO.
Thank you, Joseph. I'm so glad to be here.
Two-thirds of the space at Blackfish is a group show, and that's work by other Blackfish cooperative artists.